thank you so much for joining Dental Marketing Theory, a podcast by Gary Bird. In today's episode, Gary talks with Dr. Hendrick Lai of Sage Dental Consultants. Gary asks Dr. Hendrick about his dental journey and how he tackles growing a DSO. As always, please make sure to like, subscribe, share, and leave a comment, as all of those things really help to get the word out about Dental Marketing Theory. Hope you enjoy today's show.
All right, we are live for another episode of Dental Marketing Theory. Thanks so much for tuning in. But before we get into this wonderful guest that I have, I'm really excited for our conversation today. Please, please, please go leave a review. We have thousands of people who listen to this podcast, but we only have like 100 reviews. So that means a lot of people aren't listening. I need you to go leave a review. It'll take like 5 seconds. If you're listening on Apple, you just go press the button and you press 5-star or 1-star. You can like tell me how horrible I am. I'll actually respond to it. Or if you're on any of the other podcast platforms, same thing. Please leave a review. If you're listening on YouTube, it really helps us. Just give the video a thumbs up, subscribe, and I really, really appreciate that. Everything here is free, so it's a money-back guarantee on your review if you don't get what you paid for. All right, so today I got my friend on the phone, on the podcast, Hendrick, and what I'm really excited about today is the last time we talked, you literally like blew my mind. Your background, I'm not going to go into all your background. I'm sure that we'll go through all of that, but just your experience in the industry and also your business savviness or your just business experience. I literally was sitting there trying to keep up with you. And I just love your wealth of knowledge and what you bring to the industry. So I'm really excited for today's conversation and just stoked to talk about dental and business with you.
Well, thank you, Gary. Really appreciate you having me on as a guest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I know you head up Sage Dental Consulting, and that's kind of your day job. Tell me a little bit about what your guys are doing for clients out there.
Yeah. So Sage Dental Consulting, you know, we provide a full service dental consulting experience with customer profiles from emerging DSOs, so you know, $3 to $5 million in revenue, all the way up to established mid-cap DSOs, you know, $50 million to $100 million in revenue. So my specialty area is strategic management, strategic process, and then doing due diligence in terms of mergers and acquisitions, and you know, ensuring you integrate newly acquired businesses into your core portfolios and do that successfully.
So what right now, like what are you seeing in the dental industry as far as people needing support? Where are you coming in and providing the most support right now for those groups?
Yeah, I think, you know, what we're seeing is there's a significant number of transactions going on, not just in the DSO world, but, you know, dentist to dentist. And one of the areas that a lot of dentists and DSOs as well struggle with is the integration of new acquisitions, particularly from the cultural side of the businesses. You know, integrating processes, systems, relatively easy, you know, quite easy to align that, yeah. Quite easy to align all the information technology and communication systems. But integrating cultures from, you know, Karen and Debbie, who have been at the newly acquired practice for 45 years, into the new culture of the acquiring business tends to be a little bit more challenging. So I've been doing a lot of work with businesses on how to culturally integrate that human capital into the new portfolio without losing, you know, that depth of knowledge that certain team members have and bring with them.
So yeah, so how do you solve that? Because that is really hard. I talk to doctors all the time, and they're like, Gary, should we keep all the names of our practices the same, and as we onboard, roll them up? And I'm like, from a marketing perspective, yeah, it's great, saves you a lot of money. But from a cultural perspective, when you're trying to convince the doctor to stay on and the team to stay on and keep everybody aligned, a lot of times they don't want to be rolled up into your brand. So maybe it's better that you let them keep their brand for a while and then bring them into the family. Like that, and that's just one little part that I deal with on that side. How are you executing that and helping people on the culture side?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point that you bring up there. And, you know, obviously there's benefits and detractors from being a branded DSO or an invisible DSO. And, you know, what I'm actually seeing now is, you know, to your point, a hybrid approach where, we're allowing practices to keep their, you know, their brand name, and that, that carries a lot of value, and certainly in some cases, very, very strong brand reputation. But we're also incorporating a branded element. So in some cases, it may be a circle or a specific color that's then appended to the existing brand name. So it creates a sense of identity and a sense of belonging to the bigger organization. Now, in terms of this is always a tough one. In terms of integrating people into the business, we always have to sort of think about what are the seats that we need to be filled, and what are the responsibilities of those particular seats, and what is the, you know, the core values of the new organization. And what we need to think about is how do these people that we're bringing into the broader business, how do they align with the core values of the broader organization, and can we get them to align? So, you know, are they capable? Do they get it? And do they want it? So, you know, that's one of the first things we go through is, I hate to say it, but we sort of judge and we rate these the new people coming in to make sure that they're actually going to be fits within that organization. And, you know, when we think about things in terms of performance, performance is really a function of two different things. You know, one, it's either going to be competency, so that's having the skills, the experience needed to effectively accomplish the job. And that can usually be, you know, improved by training, improved by education. And then the other side of performance is based on something called commitment. So that's really sort of the level of motivation and the ability to adapt and change to suit a new organization. So there are going to be some people who a little bit more difficult to improve that commitment side of things, improve motivation. But, you know, that's where we sort of begin to look in terms of the situational leadership and the ability to interact and integrate people into a broader organization.
How do you, so I imagine some dentists that come on have metrics to be able to measure some of the things that you just mentioned. But if someone doesn't have those things in place, how would I go about solving for that, especially with a new company who has new leadership? My leadership doesn't know their leadership, right? So there's always that weird thing where it's like, hey, you have my job, I have your job. What's going to happen here? And then you are trying to integrate people in. How do you help them transition in that portion?
Yeah, so I actually like to use something called the situational leadership model. So it's based on the model of leadership that's been put in place by a fellow named Ken Blanchard. This was back in the 1980s, but it still holds true. And it sort of really defines itself by putting the onus of leadership and integration onto the follower, because it says that the most important part of being a leader, and by definition, you can't be a leader if you don't have a follower, is really understanding where the follower is in relation to the specific sort of context in which you're operating. So it sort of groups followers into four categories. And, you know, one is the enthusiastic beginner. I always liken it to people learning to drive a car. You know, you just learned to drive the car. You've no idea what you're doing, but you're really enthusiastic. You're really excited to do it, and you're gonna learn how to do it. And then, you know, the next step is in your journey to driving a car, you've backed your car into the mailbox a couple of times. You've got a few love taps from the wall as you've been driving around. So you're a little bit less motivated now. You're a little bit, you know, disgruntled, a little bit discouraged. Your skills are improving, but, you know, that then requires a different kind of approach to getting the best performance out of somebody. And then the next step is that, hey, you've just passed your exam, your driving test, so you're sort of competent, but you're not maybe confident enough to go out onto the highway by yourself at nighttime. So you're feeling okay skill wise, but, you know, maybe not as confident as you could be. And then the next step is that maybe you've been driving for 10, 15 years. So, you know, you're completely competent at what you do. You've got the skills to handle most situations. And you also have the sort of motivation to sort of know that you can't, you know, cross 8 lanes of traffic without putting your indicator on. So you've got a good idea.
For all the stateside friends, indicator's a blinker. Just, I wanted to translate that for you.
Yes. So, you know, it's really looking at where in one of those four categories that a follower lies, and then implementing an appropriate strategy in terms of, is it coaching, Is it sort of a much more hand-holding type of approach? Is it delegation in order to then integrate them into the appropriate fold?
Got it. That's amazing. I love that breakdown. So from your experience, that's probably the biggest thing that people are dealing with is, okay, I'm buying all these practices. We were actually just talking about some groups before we got on that are rolling up practices really quick, but then they need to kind of figure that portion out of how are we going to integrate these people culturally and support them that way. What would you say the next biggest thing is that people are really coming to you and struggling with to get support around?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is an industry-wide phenomenon, not sort of specific to DSOs, you know, groups, individual practices. But what dentistry is currently going through, it's undergoing or heading towards something called an industry shakeout. So an industry shakeout, particularly something called a seismic shift syndrome, is really what we're seeing in dentistry now. It's sort of characterized by a fairly mature industry where there are very, very few first-time buyers. So we can sort of agree that in dentistry, most people that are getting dentistry have had dentistry before. So, you know, really not first-time buyers. They're just moving from competitor to competitor in an industry. And it's also characterized by historical protected long-term returns. So dentistry, it's for the longest time been protected by, you know, local regulation, by, you know, very, very high barriers to entry in terms of, you know, you've got to be a dentist, or the cost of the specialized instruments and specialized equipment makes that barrier very,
yeah, that
very
bar of entry is super high.
Exactly. And so what a lot of things that we're seeing now happen is that a lot of structural changes and those isolating mechanisms, which were those market forces which have historically protected dentistry as an industry, are beginning to come down. So you think about things like mid-tier providers are beginning to gain traction in a lot of states. So dental therapists providing a credible alternative and substitute to some dental treatment. Telehealth platforms like Smile Direct Club, like Candid, are beginning to come to the fore, and we see some of these regulatory hurdles begin to fall, particularly with some of the successful lawsuits that some of these teledental platforms have had against state dental boards.
Yep.
So we're beginning to see some of these isolating mechanisms begin to falter, and it's putting effectively some significant downward pressure on...
Which is strange for dental, right? Like dental's never really had that before. And I know you understand business as a whole, not just dental. So what happens when an industry has a top-down pressure like that? Where you said a dental industry shakeout, which I like that term, but what does that mean? What happens next? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it a little bit of both?
It really depends on where you happen to sit within this sort of shakeout phenomena. So there's a thing that occurs in a shakeout, and it's called Henderson's Rules of Threes and Fours. What it basically says is that in order to have a stable marketplace, there can be no more than three main competitors. And of those three main competitors, the largest can have no more than four times the capitalization of the third largest. So basically what we're seeing now, we're seeing a lot of these emerging DSOs come about. We're seeing a lot of competition between established DSOs. We're seeing consolidation of dental practices, not just individual practices rolled into DSOs, but we're seeing DSOs purchase DSOs and DSOs purchase groups.
Yeah.
So what we're seeing is that move to consolidation, and, you know, we can probably between us name the big three DSOs in the country. And effectively what happens is that other people are going to have to change the way they compete and the way they approach the market in order to effectively compete. Now, it's not to say that by having three main competitors, that means no one else can compete.
Yeah.
But in order to compete in this industry shakeout, the two sort of groups that are going to emerge most successful are what are called the aggressive amalgamators and the adaptive survivors. So the adaptive survivors are the ones that, you know, have sort of their finger on the pulse and have seen something coming down the pipeline. So they've been able to put in place things that, you know, there are three main areas that adaptive survivors really focus on that allow them to sort of adapt and change and survive within the industry. You know, one is, you know, resourcing. You know, they haven't sort of let all their capital go to you know, working capital and purchasing inventory and things like that, they've actually set aside some of their capital in order to increase their facilities and to increase their human capital. So, and also leads to the second point, that they've changed their management style and leadership style from the historic founder manager model, where it's very, very informal in its structure and, you know, a lot more cohesive. But as the company's grown, it's required a lot more sort of hierarchy and a bit more sort of formality to how things are managed and run. And that's sort of a function of ensuring that two things happen. One is that you've got the capital necessary to get the best and the brightest, but it also means that these smaller organizations or these adaptive survivors, they need to make a conscious effort in order to be willing to take on outside people who are the best and pass over people that have been within the company for long periods. And that's something I see a lot of dentists and a lot of these, you know, emerging groups struggle with.
Yeah.
They feel that we have to reward loyalty, but the fiduciary responsibility of the management team is to do the right thing for the company.
This is all really good. This is why I said you guys are about to be in for a treat, because you're super smart, right? You gave us so much stuff right there. So now let's just back up a little bit. So if I'm a dentist, I have five locations, what do I need to do to be able to survive this dental shakeout?
So a couple of things you need to do. One is that in each of those five locations, you need to ensure that you have an internal economy of scale. So what I mean by internal economy of scale is that you're generating enough top line revenue at each individual location in order to sustain that location. So generally speaking, as a rule of thumb, we sort of say you reach an internal economy of scale at about $1 to $1.2 million top line revenue. So that's when you begin to cover your fixed costs and, you know, cover most of the operating expenses, and anything on top of that, you know, pretty much falls straight to your bottom line. And then after you've ensured—
And that magic number is $1.2 million a year?
$1 to $1.2 million a year, depending on the type of practice. So, you know, practices that are more driven by procedures that have high cost bases, like, say, crown and bridge, like implants, tend to have a slightly higher sort of revenue, whereas practices which are driven more by lower cost-based services, like, say, oral surgery, standard drill and fill type of dentistry, you know, you can bring that back down a little bit. But $1 to $1.2 is sort of the rule of thumb number.
So I got to take – now how do I – you said I got to take advantage of economies of scale, or I have to
– So you have to ensure you achieve that initial internal economy of scale. And then once you've got that five location practice,
how do I practically do that? Like, I hear you say that, right? And in my head, I'm like, okay, cool. I need to get to 1.2 million, but it's not that simple, right? There's things that you need to do to make sure that flips over and you start to push all that, anything above that number, down to your bottom line. Like, what are the key things there that you have to do?
Well, appropriate diagnostic capabilities. So, you know, one of the things I often see is that, you know, especially newer dentists, they pride themselves on being conservative in their nature. It's like, oh, we've got this big amalgam on, you know, tooth number 19. It seems to be holding. We'll watch it. And, you know, Martha, who's, you know, 63 now, you know, we've watched it. And then Martha retires, loses her dental benefits, and now needs a crown. Much, much more difficult to afford a crown on a, you know, fixed income than when you had dental benefits. So sometimes that conservative approach to our diagnosis is not doing our patients any favors in the longer term. So first thing first, appropriate diagnosis for the patient. Second is improving case acceptance. So, you know, what is improving case acceptance looks like? The average dental practice has a case acceptance conversion rate of about 60 to 65%. So it's marginally better than flipping a coin. So, you know, we just need to be more intentional about how we approach that. And one of the things that, you know, I've learned over the years is that we have to meet people where they are. Mm-hmm. As dentists, we always want to give the absolute sort of gold standard. And yes, in an ideal world, that's what we should do. If a patient can afford it and wants it, then yes, we should definitely provide that option, but we should also be willing to provide the silver standard,
yeah,
or the bronze standard. I mean, you think about the Olympics, you know, if you've won silver or bronze, you've still done pretty well for yourself over the
years. It's going to put, it's about putting the patient in the best possible position based on their current situation, right? And that's different than a lot of doctors approach the problem.
It's giving the patient what they want. And this is one of the reasons why companies like, say, Smile Direct Club, like Candid and like Bite, for example, they're successful, even though their product may not be technically as good as anybody else's. It's because they're willing to meet the patient where they are and give the patient what they want rather than what the doctor wants.
Got it. So that makes a lot of sense. So if I'm at five locations, how am I going to survive this dental shakeout? First step is I need to make sure I reach economy of scale, which happens between 100 or 1 million to 1.2 million, somewhere in that ballpark a year. And how do I optimize that? I need to get really good at treatment acceptance. I need to measure that, obviously. I need to be super efficient at that across the board at all five of my locations. And then what's the second part of that equation?
Yeah, and the second part of that revolves around something called an external economy of scale. So at, you know, one to three sort of locations, you can sort of have them self-manage, or even as a single owner, you can probably realistically manage them okay. Once you get to about 5 to about 14 locations, that's where you begin to get a diseconomy of scale, because it's very, very hard to manage as a single person or a single doctor. So you have to then drive for something called an external economy of scale. Now, the reason we need that is because at between sort of 5 and 14 locations, you're not generating enough sort of top line revenue at each individual practice, and then as a roll up group to support the corporate on cost layer that you really need to manage a large group. So you're just beginning to hemorrhage money. But once you actually get to about 15 or 16, and some people say even 20 locations, that's where you now have an external economy of scale, because each of your individual practices has an internal economy of scale. So you can afford to pay for this corporate on cost. You know, you can afford to pay for the management team, for the HR functions, for the marketing, for all of those sort of staff functions which go into making the line functions of a business successful.
So how do I compete then when I'm at five locations? Because I deal with this all the time where I work with a doctor. The doctor's like full-time doing dentistry, plus trying to build like a DSO, plus trying to, you know, manage everything. They don't really have anybody yet working on the business. Everybody's working in the business. So they start rolling up some leadership, maybe an office manager now is kind of operating in a hybrid role, and the doctor's operating as like a fractional CEO, and they bring in like fractional support from other places. How do they compete and make that work?
And that's a really good point there, Gary. And I think, you know, really what you're describing is, I talked about initially this sort of adaptive survivor. The other people that really perform well in the sort of industry shakeout are the aggressive amalgamators. And that's what we're describing now.
Okay.
So those aggressive amalgamators do a couple of things really well. One is that they actually remove duplication within the business to ensure that, you know, we're not having multiple offices do marketing, multiple offices do HR. And one of the things they also do very, very well is that they leverage their debt. So they actually aggressively use debt to consolidate. So they will go out and find a source of funding, whether that's, you know, traditional lenders or specialist lenders, or it could be, in some cases, private equity, if they're sort of in that particular space, to actually consolidate and acquire very, very quickly in order to achieve that external economy of scale. The other thing that these aggressive amalgamators do very well is that they control their supply chain. So they have a centralized formulary for not only their consumable products, but also a armamentarium that's centralized for the equipment that they purchase. So they have a much better and much stronger control of their supply chain. That's something that definitely is needed in order to scale and grow to that external economy of scale level.
Got it. That's so good. And now you were a dentist for a time in Australia, correct?
I was a dentist. Yes. Don't hate me. I'm a recovering dentist.
Okay. Got it. So I thought I was right on that. So if you were competing right now and you were in that like 10 location now. So you figure out the 5 location, you get up to that 10 or 14. What would you be doing right now if you were in that like 10 to 14 window location? Where would be your main focus?
So my focus if I was at that level is, you know, it's really going to be based around my strategy. So there are 3 generic strategies we can choose from. You know, one is cost leadership. So, you know, at a given level of quality, we're the cheapest. And that's not to say that it's low quality. Mm-hmm. I always liken it to luxury cars. So, you know, at the top line, you've got, say, Mercedes, Lexus, BMW, Audi, Porsche. None of those are cheap cars. But of those cars, one of them is the cost leader. So one of them is going to have to be the cheapest.
Yeah.
So, you know, probably the Lexus or something like that. Again, high quality car, but still the cost leader. Or you can be a differentiator. So you can sort of say, hey, in some way, my product or service is better than my competitors, and therefore I can demand a premium for it. Kind of challenging to do in dentistry because we've done honestly a pretty good job of commoditizing dentistry.
Yeah.
It's sort of pretty hard for me to convince my patient that my extraction is somehow better than the guy down the street.
Yeah.
And
even if it is, they don't realize that till much. It's almost like when you buy batteries, right? And it's like, my battery is better than this battery. Well, until you use it all the way and it's 6 months later and I use the whole pack, you really don't. It's really hard to compare side by side.
Absolutely. And for the most part, patients don't really know good dentistry from bad dentistry.
Exactly.
All they know is if you were nice to them and if you hurt them.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, you know, they're not going to know a good amalgam with, you know, tertiary anatomy carved in. All they're going to know is that either this filling fell out of my head when I walked into the car park or it's in there and it's comfortable.
Yeah.
That's all they know. So, you know, that's the second strategy. And the third strategy is a focus strategy where I'm going to focus my efforts on a specific market segment, whether that is providing implants, doing ortho, or even sort of focusing on specific demographics within a market. So I might say I want to focus on, you know, the Chinese-speaking community in a specific geographic area.
Yep.
So that's a legitimate sort of strategy. So, you know, what would I be doing if I was at that 14 location mark? I'd be saying, well, what's my actual strategy going to be?
Yeah.
You know, am I going to be the cost leader? Because if I'm the cost leader, all of my messaging has to be focused around that and all of my systems and processes have to support that particular strategy. So if I want to be the cost leader, I can't go around saying that I'm going to buy the most expensive equipment because simply that doesn't work.
Yep. You can't have fish tanks with sharks in the lobby and say you're the cost leader, right?
Exactly. And by the same token, if I say I'm differentiated and I'm, you know, going to
Before we jump to that thought, I want to pick something. So every dentist tells me we're the quality person, right? We're the quality. So how, like, I know how to, like, I have an answer from this from a marketing perspective, but how do you deal with that when everybody says they're the quality leader?
So what is quality? You know, I actually ask my clients this all the time, and I tell people that by definition, and this is an ISO 9001 definition, which is the international standard for quality, is quality is whatever your customer says it is. So if your customer says, I want a red car, and you build them the fastest blue car in the world with, you know, whale skin leather seats and, you know, a V20 engine, it's not quality because they wanted a red car.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, from a marketing perspective, I don't think a lot of people understand, like, if you want to really convey, like if you do dental implants, you really want to convey quality, you have to appeal to the emotional side, because general dentistry is more about proximity. Do you have good Google reviews? And did you answer your phone? And do you have an appointment within the next couple of days? If you're going to say, okay, well, what are the best quality from a dental implant or an Invisalign or braces or whatever, then what you're really saying is I have to educate this patient on what that quality means. And that's one of the hardest kinds of marketing to do. And then, so then you say, okay, well, I'll appeal to their emotional side. And if you appeal to their emotion side, it's like, well, they're not able to eat. So we're going to help you eat again. But most dentists don't think that way because it's so far removed from the tactical part of dentistry.
You are 100% right there, Gary. And one of the things I speak to my clients about is, how do you articulate a value proposition? And, you know, as we know, a value proposition comprises an emotional as well as a functional component to it. And I always tell my dentist this, and a lot of dentists are very, very good at being technicians.
Yeah.
But, you know, people don't buy the product or the service. They buy the benefit that that product or service provides. And I always point to something like, you see those drug ads on TV, you know, it says, oh, you take this drug and it's going to reduce your A1C and it's going to do this and do that. But then you look at the imagery in the background, no one cares about reducing the A1C. The benefit of doing reduction in the A1C is that I can go to my grandson's birthday and have a
piece of cake. I can play now with my kids.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it provides that benefit of the benefit. And, you know, giving a value proposition, and people talk about value propositions all the time, it's basically sending a message. And we know that messages or sending a message has three components. One is the sender, one is the actual message, and one is the receiver. So before people go through and talk about their value propositions, I actually encourage officers and my clients to go through and do something called a brand mantra exercise. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, a lot of the time the brand mantra is intended for the staff, and it's the staff who are ultimately articulating the value proposition to the patients. So if the staff really don't have a good sense of what the brand stands for and what it represents, it's very, very hard for them to send the appropriate message that's going to be received by the receiver in the way you intend it to be.
Yeah, because I think the reason for that is, again, because dentists focus on this the mm-hmm. technical side of dentistry, but the patient doesn't receive dentistry that way. And I know I'm beating a dead horse here, but I think it's really important. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll give you an example. If you go into almost any market and you say, we're open at 6 a.m. and we close at 7 p.m., you instantly have a competitive advantage that mm-hmm. people will view your dentistry as approachable and you're going to help me, because no one else or very few people actually do that. Or to your point earlier, if you come in and service a particular demographic that speaks a different language where no one's speaking that language, you instantly have lowered all the thresholds of all the confusing dentist stuff. Almost doesn't matter anymore, because you are now going to help them bridge that gap. And so it's really just flipping what we do and more talking about how we do it or why we do it.
Yeah, and we know that people make decisions based on emotion and then try to justify it and rationalize it later with logic. So, you know, it behooves us to focus on some of that emotional stuff. And that's why I really love the brand mantra idea, because it draws in an emotional modifier, it draws in a descriptive modifier, and it draws in a functional modifier. So, you know, obviously that emotional modifier is what you want your customers to actually feel when they think about your service or your brand. And then obviously the descriptive modifier is, hey, who is this product? Who is this service? Who is this brand actually intended for? And then the functional modifier is, you know, what's the actual benefit of the experience that you're going to receive from using this particular product or this particular service? I always go back to the example of, you know, the Nike, brand mantra. So authentic athletic performance. So, you know, that's what we want people to feel. Or the Disney brand mantra of magical family entertainment. So it allows the, you know, the staff member to say, hey, this is what we're expecting. We want our customers to feel.
See, that's crazy, because when I think Disney, I think long lines, really expensive, poor food, and leg cramps and digestive issues the next day.
Should have bought the fast pass, Gary.
They change it. They always change the rules on the fast pass too. That's the other thing. Once you figure out Disney and what they're doing, they change everything. So anyways, can't tell, I'm jaded.
but you know, the point is that obviously you're bringing in, once you actually can put in place a brand mantra before you articulate your value proposition, it allows you to put in place the emotional aspect of it, which is what is necessary for people
because
to
it's,
make that decision.
It's so true, because so that's such a good point. With the Disney thing, my kids don't feel that way, right? My kids love Disney. I have this negative picture of Disney and what they do to you from a marketing perspective, but my kids are like, no, it's the best thing in the world. And their brand mantra is so strong that it goes into my kids, and then they override my feelings about it because that's how strong they've built that.
Yep. And I mean, arguably, we see that in the dental office where the, you know, the first experience or that first contact when a patient rings in as a potential new patient, and you have somebody pick up the phone. And look, I have clients in, I'm going to say on the East Coast in New York that answer the phone and say, doctor's office, what do you want?
Yeah.
Like, well, that's not really a great sort of first experience for a patient.
I love your Northeast accent too, by the way, when you did that. That was awesome.
Well, the Australian accent doesn't fit in anywhere, so it just sounds terrible no matter what. But yeah, I mean, it's that first experience which then sort of guides everything else, because you've only got about 5 to 7 seconds to make that, you know, first impression on somebody. And that first impression is going to color whatever comes next. So, you know, if you're doing a full arch case, or you're promoting a full arch case, if a patient was sort of on the fence about it, but maybe thinks about, hey, I had a really good experience here, I feel super confident that they know what they're doing and they're going to do a great job for me, versus like, oh, I'm on the fence, had a really bad experience with, you know, Debbie at the front desk, they're less likely to do two things. One is complete the case, or two is be happy with the final outcome. So, you know, it's really ensuring that you send that value proposition message based around the emotion attached to it.
Got it. Okay. So 10 years from now, those are all great. It's super good content here. I love learning from you. So, all right. So we're 15 years rolled out. So it's 2037, 2038, somewhere in there. What's based on your experience in other industries and understanding the business world and what you see happening in dentistry, what is the dental world going to look like?
So we are going to see sort of mass consolidation, particularly, you know, whether it's through DSOs or through group sort of roll-ups. You know, we're certainly seeing that now, certainly over the last sort of 10 to 15 years. We've seen the traditional private practice numbers drop in dentistry from about 65% to about 50%. And then we've seen roughly year-on-year growth of 1 to 1.5% in the DSO space during that period as well. Now, there's a few estimates that sort of suggest that the DSO space by about 2025 will account for about 60% of the capitalization of the market.
Wow.
And that's likely to continue to accelerate as we move forward. We certainly know that the investment dollars continue to flow at a much higher rate towards the DSOs than they do to traditional private practice. And you know, one of the rules in business is always follow the wisdom of the market. You know, maybe one or two people will get it wrong, but very, very unlikely for the entire market to get it wrong. So, you know, that's where it's headed. But that's, again, not to say that...
Unless it's NFTs is the only exception to that.
Well,
I'm playing. Yeah. That's a curveball.
But that's not to say that like individual dental practices can't compete effectively against in this particular market. You know, one of the things that, you know, if you can't be a aggressive amalgamator or an adaptive survivor, you know, one of the key strategies that works very, very well in the market is the focused strategy, where you do begin to focus on specific market segments.
Yeah.
And then secondary to that is that, you know, individual practices or sort of smaller groups can compete and achieve economies of scale by joining sort of strategic alliances. So, you know, large groups, like there are a few around the place, buying clubs, some people might call them, but, you know, there are ways that smaller businesses and smaller capitalized businesses can achieve that economy of scale that is necessary to compete.
That's awesome. This is so good. What other topics have we not covered that you think would be important for us to go over?
I mean, maybe we can sort of go back to, you know, the idea of, you know, what quality is. One of the things I really speak a lot about is this thing called the value pyramid. So our listeners might remember the old Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that pyramid where you got your physiological needs down the bottom, and as you work your way up, you got safety needs, and then right at the very top, you've got, you know, transcendence, you know, self-actualization, being the best you can be. So there was a company that actually converted that Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is, you know, what's important and necessary in organizational development. So Maslow's hierarchy of needs, important in psychological and self-development, into something which works in the business world. And they call it the value pyramid. Mm-hmm. So it starts with sort of this base level, these functional needs. And it is a pyramid. And at the bottom of that functional pyramid is quality. But the thing is, it's not quality as we understand it. It's perceived quality of the customer. So if the customer perceives the quality to be good, even though technically it's atrocious, and look, I know a lot of dentists that will understand this. You know, you get somebody walk in with a set of dentures that you put in and you think, how are these things staying in your mouth? They're sort of moving all over the place. But the patient thinks they're the best things, you know, since sliced bread. And then, you know, but on the flip side, you get somebody that comes in with a set of dentures that are like just technically brilliant. They sit perfectly on the ridge. You know, the emergence profile is perfect. Everything is perfect, but patient hates them and thinks they're terrible. So it's all about the level of minimum level of perceived quality of the customer, with the idea that every sort of incremental step of quality above that doesn't result in any more customer satisfaction. So, you know, and the idea behind this value pyramid is that just like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if we don't sort of hit all of the value elements in one area, it's impossible for us then to move up to different sort of levels within that value pyramid. So a lot of us in dentistry try to sort of say, hey, if you come and see me, I'm going to give you the best smile in the world and do this, that, and the other. But if we don't ensure that those other value elements at the bottom, and there's about 35 or 40 of them, are met, then, you know, getting a long-term buy-in for a customer is just not going to be there.
Do you want to dive down that road of those quality pillars?
Well, I mean, is there anything you specifically think that the audience really could take away, and you know, what kind of value that you think would be best to add?
It's hard because we have a mix of people on the podcast, right? So Our audience is partially dentists that listen to it. And so I think what you've provided already is like huge when they start to change the way that they're thinking. But then there's also the other side, there's the business side of it, right? And so maybe if you have something that we could attach to this with the 40 different layers of that, I think that would be huge.
Yeah, I can certainly make that value pyramid available to the audience and give my sort of analysis around it and, you know, what the most important value elements are to focus on.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Is there any other topics that we didn't cover that you think are important to the audience?
I think, you know, one of the questions that I think was written down by the team was, you know, what's the main most important aspect in terms of customer or patient sort of value proposition versus what we think? And maybe we did cover off on that a little bit,
Gary. A little bit, but let's cover that. So let me frame that up. So what do you feel that the most important focus of from a patient proposition standpoint is from the clinical perspective? So thinking in as a dentist and looking out at the patient, how can we best position the office for the patient to be able to come in and consume what we do or what we're really good at as a technician?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to actually understand what the patient wants, you know, to meet them where they are. So in terms of customer satisfaction or patient satisfaction, there was a survey done, I want to say it was now going on about 16 years ago, which sort of ranked different sort of criteria and where they stood in terms of customer satisfaction. And the most important criteria was communication. So did my dentist listen to me and hear what I had to say? And even part of that is also hearing what I didn't say. Because as dentists, we tend to put a lot of emphasis on technical skills and technical ability. But out of the seven sort of criteria that were evaluated, technical skills came in at number four. So it was in terms of, you know, customer satisfaction and, you know, what customers are looking for, all they demanded was a minimum level of technical skill. And you know, that minimum level in their minds is promoted by the fact that you've got your dental license and you've got your dental degree. So you should have a minimum level of technical capability.
Well, but I think we've all been through this before, right? So we go to the oil change place and we say, hey, we need an oil change, which is the equivalent of getting our teeth cleaned, right? So it's the basic service that we understand. And then they go, hey, your such and such is broken and this is, and you know, I don't know anything about cars, but they start rattling off all these problems with your car. I feel stupid, right? Like, I'm like, I don't even know what any of that means. and what is that going to cost is where my first brain goes to. And then it's like, okay, that's how much it's going to cost, but do I actually need this? And it's really, there's some communication breakdown that has to happen there. Dentists tend to struggle with that, to your point, that you're like, this is not where most people's brains go when they think about dentistry. How does someone get better at that, at actually communicating the dental side of things?
Yeah, I think it's sort of understanding that, you know, as dentists, for us, teeth are everything. And, you know, and perhaps as dentists, we don't understand that what we're providing in dentistry is in some ways selling. So we need to have a good understanding of the consumer or customer, or in this case, patient, purchasing decision cycle. So, you know, when, to your point around the oil change, for example, when we go in, we expect that we're getting an oil change, maybe our air filter replaced or something like that. And the thing is that when they rattle off that we need this and that done, we didn't realize we had a problem. So the first you know, step in that consumer sort of purchase decision is, does the consumer actually know they have a problem? You know, in dentistry, chances are the patient doesn't know that they've got a problem. So it's educating them that you have a problem here. And then the next step is understanding of, you know, let the patient understand what their alternatives are. You know, what are the alternatives and why should you choose this particular alternative? Then give them time to evaluate the alternatives and then make the selection for them. And once that selection is made, and this is actually probably most important, is ensuring that there's appropriate follow-up once treatment's been provided and a decision's been made, because that last step is the biggest determinant of post-purchase decision-making, which what that means in terms of business is that that's going to enhance your lifetime customer value rather than make it a one-and-done deal.
Yeah, making sure they understand the value behind it, right? And that this was a really smart decision. It's going to save you money in the long haul, all that kind of stuff, right?
Absolutely. And another thing I have to mention is I would encourage all of the listeners out there to start to capture metrics around two things. One is the Net Promoter Score. I'm a big believer in the Net Promoter Score, because what we certainly see is that in terms of the Net Promoter Score, the higher the score, the higher the lifetime customer value associated with that particular client. And on the flip side is that the studies tell us that in the United States, the average dental office has a Net Promoter Score of 1. And when we consider that's a scale of minus 100 to positive 100, what that tells us is that with a Net Promoter Score of 1, patients, you know, it's 6 of one, half a dozen of the other. They really don't care much.
Which sounds really bad, but actually it means there's awesome opportunity. You don't have to do a lot to separate from the crowd, right?
Yep. And, you know, and to put some context around it, you know, one is not necessarily great. It's not necessarily bad. It's sort of, you know, right in the middle. So there's opportunity and there's obviously some places to improve. But some of our sort of most hated, you know, partners within the industry, like insurance companies, some of them have a Net Promoter Score of, you know, 16. Which unfortunately tells us that our patients feel better about dealing with a dental insurance company than they do about dealing with a dental office.
We're going to have to, I'm joking, but we're going to have to lead with the title, why life insurance is better, or patients like why life insurance better than dental, right? Like, that's a problem. But, and again, I just see that, I hear that, and I'm just like, amazing opportunity, right? You only have to make minor adjustments to fix little things. It was funny. I posted online. I said, hey, I was sitting in the dental office. It happened to be a Pacific Dental brand office. And they always run like 10 minutes late, right? Like, that's just pretty common. And I've been to tons of other dental offices and they're always like 10 minutes late. I didn't mean to like offend anybody, but I was just like, why do dental offices always run 10 minutes late to a hygiene appointment? I think you commented on it. A couple other people commented on it and said, you know, here's why, here's what's going on. But a lot of people took offense to it of like, well, what, you know, this is what we're dealing with. And I just feel like the perception around this is like, you know, this is just hard, just deal with it. When there are solutions to it, there are solutions that you can fix. You can't fix everything, but you can choose a couple things to be really, really good at and wow the patients.
Absolutely. you made such a good point there. And I tell my clients this, if you can learn to do only two things in dentistry that and you will be loved by patients, is see them on time and learn to give a painless like dental injection. The rest of your dentistry can be atrocious, but if you can do those two things, you will be beloved by your patients forever.
Yep. 100%. Yep. I love it. Well, this has been really, really good. If someone wants to, obviously, if you're in the dental industry and you don't have support and you don't know where your next step should go, it's very, very clear who you should talk to. But if someone wanted to reach out to you and kind of pick your brain on what you guys do or how you can help them, what's the best way to connect with you?
Oh, you can connect with us on our website, which is sagedentalconsulting.com. Or you can reach out to me directly on my email at hendrick@sagedentalconsulting.com.
Awesome. Thanks so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. We're going to have to do this again. We could have talked for two more hours about this stuff. So I'm going to definitely bring you back on if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you and appreciate your listeners.
Yep. Thank you.
Take care.